This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Dr. Arthur Tim Garson is an internationally recognized pediatric cardiologist. He serves as provost of the University of Virginia, and he's the co-author of Healthcare Half-Truths. He joins me live in studio. How are you? It's good to see you.
Great, Coy. Good to be back. Thank you.
Your summer going well? Everything?
Terrific.
Good.
Got all the deans here and on board, and on we go.
Yes, indeed. And when you started as provost, there were a whole lot of deans who needed to be hired. That's a lot of dinners and a lot of interviews, I would imagine.
I thought I was going to gain 1 pound per dean. I didn't quite gain that, but a little.
Let's start first with the difference. You've talked about this before. Before we start talking about what's going on in the news and what may or may not happen, explain to us first the distinction between healthcare and medical care, because personally, I believe that's one of the most important messages you have, because so many Americans tend to lump that together, and we shouldn't.
It's especially important as we move forward into what everybody's calling healthcare reform, and it's probably rational to say that. Healthcare is the big overarching, how do we take care of the entire population? Healthcare is about life expectancy. It's about infant mortality. But maybe the easiest way to think of it is that the healthcare index of life expectancy in Harlem, for example, in New York, is lower than the life expectancy in Bangladesh.
Oh, now, my God.
Now, clearly, that's not access to a doctor. That is the social issues of drug abuse, poverty, and things that lead to death, premature death, that are certainly preventable and more than medical care. In fact, life expectancy in the U.S., which is health care, is 40% of our own behavior, 40% of our own behavior, our own lifestyle, 30% genetics, 20% public health, and 10% medical care. So medical care, the things that doctors, nurses, patients do with each other, is 10% of life expectancy. That's medical care.
Wow, and 40% is stop smoking, stop overeating, and get to the gym.
You betcha. Correct.
We're talking with Dr. Tim Garson. So let me just ask a very open-ended questions, and please feel free to talk at length. What are your thoughts about what's going on right now? Because when I first started watching this a few months ago, I thought, hey, it looks like they might really do something. We might have some positive reform, because I think everybody would agree we have to make some kind of positive changes. And then lately I've started thinking, boy, this looks like the 90s all over again. It doesn't look like they're going to do much.
Well, I, the eternal optimist, someone talked about the Ever-Ready Bunny that I sort of keep popping up and saying, we're going to do this. Statistically, you know, six times in the last century, we blew it. And my real fear is that this time it may not be any better. I'm still optimistic. The reason I'm optimistic really at the top is the President of the United States really wants to make this happen. It is absolutely clear that President Obama and his staff, I was at the White House a couple of weeks ago, clearly want this to happen. I believe they've done it right. I believe what they've done is they've shown leadership. They've shown the idea that, yes, we must get it done, but they've given it to the Congress. Now, what's happened in the Congress, we've all gotten to watch, which is that, unfortunately, the special interest groups have attacked yet again from all sides, and that's causing concern.
And we're talking with Dr. Tim Garson of the University of Virginia. The phone lines are open, of course, at 977-1070 if you'd like to join this conversation and share your thoughts about healthcare reform. It almost seems, Dr. Garson, like they destroy that. What we need to have is a conversation as a country about what we need to do, and it seems that we're not even getting to the point where we can have the conversation, because as soon as Washington says, hey, this is something we might want to do, it's like the special interests come in and kill it, whether that is the insurance companies or the drug companies. I'm not saying that, but it's like we can never get to the point where there's a substantive policy conversation about real change.
I agree. The issue right now has come down to a couple of things that are pretty divisive. in the Congress. And one of them is a little bit arcane, this idea of having a public insurance program that the Congress is sharply divided on this, of whether we absolutely must have a public insurance program that would compete right alongside of private programs. And clearly there is one group of Democrats very, very much in favor of it, saying we will not vote for any bill that has anything but a public plan, and there are a large group of Republicans that are saying the opposite.
We're talking with Dr. Tim Garson, Provost of the University of Virginia, about the debate on national health care reform. Mimi is on line one. Mimi, thanks for the call. You're on with Dr. Garson. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon. Now, I'm sure I'm going to sound mean and selfish.
Not you. Come on.
But years ago, first let me say that years ago we had hospital insurance. You went to the hospital and it paid part of your bill. There was naturally a copay. They used to call it deductibles. But you went to the doctor, you paid your bill. You went needed medicine, you paid for that. We didn't have insurance that paid for every woman fancy, just hospital. Now, then you could buy something called major medical, which took care of the biggies. But in my opinion, that's the way to run the healthcare system, and to offer it to everyone and not pay for anyone, because you get what you can pay for. If you tell people that they can have prime healthcare, it's wrong. It's wrong to tell everybody they can have that. That would mean that I could march into any hospital or doctor's office and say, I want the same health care Donald Trump has or Barack Obama, because God knows the people in Congress have health care that would make your hair stand on end if you tried to get it. And so telling people that they're going to get good health care with a government plan, everybody thinks they're going to get the same thing, and everybody shouldn't get the same thing. You get what you can afford. If you can afford to have the Donald Trump of health care, then you get to have it. If you can't afford it, you don't get it.
Mimi, thanks for the comment. Let's give Dr. Garson an opportunity to respond.
Well, Mimi, I didn't think that sounded mean, so don't feel too bad about that. The way Carolyn Engelhard and I put it in our book, the kind of health care that we all ought to get is something that if you were sitting in a room with your neighbor, your friend, your family, or somebody from a foreign country, and you could look them square in the face and say, you know what, that's okay, that and no less than that. I agree with you that what we have to do is everybody doesn't drive a Cadillac. On the other hand, everybody has food. And I think that what we've got to do is not just have a minimum for everybody. We have to have an acceptable minimum for everybody. Now, that's going to be a big debate of what that word acceptable means. What's okay? Does everybody get a heart transplant? I don't know. That's one of the huge issues right now, is what should everybody have? But I really do feel that everybody would agree everybody has to have something, and that something has got to be acceptable.
And just to respond to what Mimi was saying, you get what you can afford, and if you can't afford something, you're not going to get it. The problem with that is that those who can't afford anything, the rest of us are paying for it. Can you talk about that? Because that's the to me, that's the one part that's always overlooked. It's like, I am literally paying for my neighbor who doesn't have health care.
Yeah, let me come back to that. I'll come back to that second. I think the first thing is, just to be clear, I believe that, and I think most of us would, that everybody should have a floor, and that floor is okay. That floor is not extravagant, but is okay.
A national base.
Some base that everybody has, even if you, I mean, and especially, obviously, if you can't afford it. Now, if you can afford more, go for it. So if you want Donald Trump, you betcha, but I don't think, and I think most of us would not think, that everybody gets Donald Trump health care.
Right.
But everybody has to have an acceptable amount of health care, everybody. That's what health care coverage is, and then we have to decide what that is, and that's going to be tough, right?
So, right.
So that's pretty important. And I think if you say, what is it that I believe must, underline must 55 times, be the issue that comes out of any bill that comes out of the Congress that the president signs, it is a way, eventually, but a certain way, to have the 50 million uninsured covered. That's the must have.
Full coverage.
You bet. Everybody, you know, those that cannot afford it must be able to have a minimum level of health care coverage.
And for you, government is part of that process, ensuring that.
Well, the subsidies, right, there are two ways to do this. It's not that complex. There are really only two ways that you wind up providing for health insurance. One is through a public plan such as Medicaid. Okay, so children who are under the age of 19 are covered by a state federal program called Medicaid, and Medicaid arranges for doctors to take care of you.
That provides a floor for a certain segment of the population.
Correct. Same thing for Medicare if you're over 65.
Right.
That's a public plan.
Or members of Congress or veterans.
There you go. Now, in the middle, people between 19 and 64 currently are covered by private insurance. And there are therefore only really two ways in healthcare reform to cover people. Either you increase the number of people who are covered by Medicaid, or you give the government, gives people vouchers or some way of paying for health insurance in the private market. That's it. It's one or the other. Massachusetts has done both. So the Commonwealth of Massachusetts did not begin with a very high rate of uninsured. The national average is 16% uninsured. Massachusetts started with 10%. But they're now under 2%. And they have taken the approach that a lot of the federal legislation is modeled after. And what Massachusetts has done is increased coverage in Medicaid and also increased the ability for people to buy private coverage. But the government, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, subsidizes, pays for the minimum premium, depending upon how much money you make.
We're talking healthcare reform with the provost of the University of Virginia, Dr. Tim Garson. Mimi, thank you so much for the call. Great point. Let's go to Greg on line two. Greg, you're on with Dr. Garson. Go right ahead.
Hello, Dr. Garson. It's Greg Quinn.
Hey, Greg.
You're probably going to disagree with me. I'm a stonemason, and I work really hard for my money, and I don't make a lot of money as far as things go. And you know, I had some serious issues. I owed the hospital tens of thousands of dollars, a lot of money. And I got up every day and went to work and paid it off myself. I resent having to pay for people who don't have the same work ethic as I do. I resent it wholeheartedly. I think really old people need to be covered and babies. But if you got people in projects who are taking crack, I don't have any sympathy for them except for they need to get sober and they need to get a job. And I would resent a mandate from any government program where I had to work harder at 51 years old laying stone to pay for other people. Can you comment?
Sure. I'm not sure we disagree, Greg. What I would say is, for starters, back to the end of Mimi's and, in fact, the beginning of your question, we are currently, everybody that has family insurance, the estimate is that of the average, which is about $12,000 a year, of that $12,000 premium, we are paying $1,000 of subsidy for the people who don't have insurance now.
Yeah, Greg is already paying for
the
people who don't have
insurance. So you already are. Now, I would say, let's do the math real quickly. The math is that 75% of the people who have no health insurance can't afford it. Now, if you're going to say, and that, by the way, says that 25% can, I would say shame on them. Right? I mean, if you really can afford health insurance, and the usual group is between 20 and 30 who think that they're indestructible until they have an accident or a baby,
right.
If you can afford it, then you should pay for it. But remember, the average individual premium is around $3,000 a year. the average for somebody who is making minimum wage is about $10,000 or $11,000 per year. And you do the math and you say, ah, you mean that premium is 30% of somebody's income. Not going to happen. So I agree with you. People who can afford it must pay for it. People who cannot afford it should have some variety of a subsidy because they're working as hard as you are, right? There are people who are working in fast food restaurants, making $10,000 or $11,000 a year and don't have health insurance. Those people are working their tails off, working for their kids, and cannot afford it.
Yeah. And the money that we, that those of us who have health insurance now, the extra money we pay that's built into our premiums to cover the folks who don't have it, is your argument that that would be less if we provide some type of national floor so that nobody falls through the cracks?
It certainly should be. And that's where, you know, when you get into this very, very detailed, who's doing the calculations about what, that money should be figured in as something that people are already paying, that should figure out that, therefore, the insurance premiums should go down. Correct.
Right. So, and that's what really fascinates me the most about this. And it's a very subtle argument that most people miss. This is the national health care, the argument to provide health care for everybody is the fiscally conservative argument. This is what's going to actually save money, you know, out of your pocket, what you pay for health care. At least that's the argument.
It is. Recognize that it's going to cost less, but still insuring 50 million people is a $150 billion a year event. It's not clear to me why people in Washington are so surprised and are aghast at, oh my goodness, it's $1 trillion over 10 years. Well, of course it is. Do the math. If a premium for an individual is $2,000 times 50 million people, guess what? That's $100 billion a year. And that's if it was $2,000. If it's a $3,000 premium, it's $150 billion a year. That shouldn't surprise anybody.
Right,
so
right.
Those numbers, I mean, Carolyn and I wrote the book 3 years ago. We had $100 billion in the book 3 years ago. That's not a surprise. It's a huge amount of money, but it shouldn't be surprising people.
We're talking with Tim Garson, the provost of the University of Virginia. Got a lot of folks waiting patiently online. Dan's on line one. Dan, you're on with Dr. Garson. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Hi, Dr. Garson. Hey. I appreciate you listening to me today.
Hey, Dan.
I am a graduate nursing student, and my goal is to open a preventative medicine clinic one day. And you mentioned earlier that 40% of the lifespan is due to or from preventable causes. Also, Obama's plan recently, or his original plan, was to dedicate a significant amount of money to prevention of health, you know, with health care. And my question is, how realistic is it for someone like me, who is clearly interested in health care and prevention, to actually open up with some of these clinics and actually have prevention in mind, rather than not on paper, but in actuality, helping these people? Clearly, the research has shown that prevention saves money and helps prevent, you know, chronic diseases and takes a more proactive approach to healthcare.
It's going to save a ton of money, isn't it? I mean, if done right.
So let's take this apart little by little, and if we've got 6 or 7 hours, we'll get it right.
We've got 2 minutes before we break for news.
Here we go.
But we will come back.
Here we go.
Dr. Garson will be with us in the next half hour.
We'll do it real quick. First of all, prevention is absolutely the right thing, absolutely the right thing. And so to answer your question directly, any plan that comes out in the future in terms of what we were talking about with the last person about what must be included, prevention must be included. So you will get paid for prevention, clearly. You will get paid for prevention because it's the right thing to do.
Because it's cheaper to pay for the prevention than when they get sick, right?
It is in the narrow, in the near term, it's absolutely cheaper. It is absolutely cheaper to keep people out of the hospital, to keep them from breaking their legs. So workplace safety, all that stuff's cheaper. Just remember that in the big picture, big study from Holland, obese people die at the age of 80 and save $50,000 in lifetime medical care costs compared to non-obese people who die at 83. You die earlier, you save money. So the problem in the big picture is it may not save money the way we practice medicine today. On the other hand, if we've got more Dans and more of you, and the idea of keeping people incredibly healthy right up until the time they die, then prevention will save money. My father, and I guess we can quit with this, my father said, in aging, the whole purpose is to make early old age last as long as possible and late old age last 15 minutes. If we can pull that off, prevention will save money.
Dr. Tim Garson is provost of the University of Virginia, the co-author of Healthcare Half-Truths. My guest this hour on Charlottesville Right Now. More after a break with local news and weather. This is Charlottesville Right Now. Dr. Tim Garson is provost at the University of Virginia, the co-author of Healthcare Half-Truths, and he joins me live in studio for a conversation about healthcare reform. We've got a lot of folks online. Please stay with me. It's 977-1070. We'll be right with you. But before we go back to the phones, we were talking during the break, and you raised this topic before we broke for news just a few minutes ago, this idea that in the West, we really place a strong value on healthcare that will prolong death for the elderly, when arguably the quality of life is diminished considerably for some of these folks. And that is where so much of the money on healthcare is actually spent.
Yeah, actually, in the U.S., and it turns out, of all things, in Holland, so it's not just the U.S., 10% of our dollars are spent in the last year. Now, pick a number, $240 billion in the last year of life. That's a lot of money. Now, you say that, and you say, well, good grief, but we all face this differently. So it is very difficult to actually grapple with. So, for example, the issues of a living will. Everybody should have one. The issues of do not resuscitate. Well, people should do that. Hospice. All the right things to do, they are all underutilized. Then Governor, now Senator Mark Warner, is very interested in this and is talking about legislation dealing with trying to make end of life something that people actually grapple with. So, for example, an idea that came out of the UVA Law School is, shouldn't everybody have a durable power of attorney? Something, you know, where you at least say, can I have a discussion with somebody? Not what is it, but just at least that I've faced it. One of the real problems, and we all understand this, is that it seems obvious, but it's not. You don't know when the last year of life starts, right? I've had two parents die, and they both had a similar disease, and one took 6 months and one took 3 years. So they don't know, right? The red flag does not go up and does not say, okay, here it is, end of life, because now it starts. And because some people, you say, well, good grief, I'm going to get better. I'm going to be fine. Doctors think that. Patients think that. Families think that. And so, again, better and better research should be done on figuring out when that starts. So at least you can look at somebody and say, listen, you know, the odds are overwhelming that this isn't going to go well. Why don't you get your affairs in order, and why didn't your family take part in some of these decisions?
But it's so American to say, I don't care what the odds are. If there's some medicine, if there's some procedure, I'm going to do it.
It is, and that's not something that I'm getting ready to take on and fight today, because I'll probably be just the same, but it's probably not the right answer. It's probably not the right answer, but you're right. It's very American, and that ain't one I'm going to take on today.
We're talking with Tim Garson, provost at the University of Virginia. Let's go to the phones. Mark waiting patiently on line one. Mark, you're on with Dr. Garson. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a bit of a way to handle this with the free market and maybe tax incentives. In other words, if we were able to deduct from our taxes healthcare, real healthcare, not, you know, plastic surgery and stuff like that. But if we could deduct real healthcare from our taxes and be sort of like a corporation that gets to deduct our healthcare expenses from their taxes, wouldn't that make it more portable and let the free market thrive as well?
Well, in a lot of cases, the money paid by corporations for medical care is excluded from the individual's income tax already. So essentially, you're getting that if you have employer-based insurance. If you don't, that certainly is something that has been talked about a lot. But one of the big issues being discussed right now in Washington is, should that exclusion, meaning should the individual get the burden of the medical care premium on them, and then maybe it's deductible to a certain extent or not. So when you, the, one of the big debates right now is, do you cap? Do you say, okay, business, you're only allowed to pay $12,000 for a family premium, and anything more that you want to offer, I'm sorry, that's taxable to the employee. That's one of the big considerations. That was one of the big considerations during the campaign.
Let me ask a question. And Mark, thank you for the call. We've got a line open at 977-1070. We're talking healthcare reform with Dr. Tim Garson at the University of Virginia. Let me ask a broader strokes question here based on Mark's question. Do you see free market solutions to this challenge? I mean, is there an element, or small or large, when it comes to free market solutions for what we're facing?
There has to be free market. That's the name. United States equals free market. Now, to say there's only a free market basis for this is probably not necessary either. There are going to be different approaches, much as was done in Massachusetts, where there was a expansion of the public program and a clear expansion of the free market of insurance. Now, what I would say that we have to be really careful with, and it's actually good news, is in order for a market to work, people need to understand what they're buying, right? I can understand that I go and buy a blue shirt and it's blue and it's got all the buttons on it. That's a whole lot easier to understand than a health insurance policy. And so what we must do, and in fact what we at UVA are doing, we've got a questionnaire that Wendy Cohn has created that's now in testing that gets people the health information the way they want it. So we have to recognize, if we're going to ask people to take part in a free market that I think is right as part of the solution, we got to educate them. And we can't educate them at the 14th grade level. We've got to educate them the way they want to be educated.
So we actually know what we're buying.
Absolutely.
Do you ever see, Mimi asked earlier about the days when we had hospital insurance. Do you see any type of return to things we've done in the past as part of our future solutions?
Well, I'll give you two. One will come like out of left field. I'll do that second. The first is the whole notion of high deductible health plans is exactly what was Major Medical. So this whole high deductible health plan, health savings account is exactly that. Right, you pay the first X thousand dollars, and then the insurance kicks in. That's what that is. All right, there are two, and so conceptually that works. The individual pays up to a point. We know from studies done 20 years ago and recently that people skimp on medical care when they're paying for it. So we know that. Statistically, the amount of prescription refills is down if you're paying for it as opposed to somebody else paying for it. Now, that's wrong, but that's our behavior. So we have to be careful with these high deductible plans in two ways. One is that absolutely necessary drug and treatments has got to somehow be covered where people won't skimp, because people do skimp when they're paying for themselves.
When they skimp, they don't get well, or they
that's right.
Stay
and
sick?
The data are they skimp equally on stuff that's necessary and stuff that's not necessary. That's the data. Okay? That's the first part of it. The second part of it is that preventive care has got to be first dollar. So if you say, okay, you've now got a $5,000 deductible, and by the way, you're supposed to have a mammogram and this and that and the other thing, people really skimp on that. So the way to get around that, and many of the high deductible plans right now, in fact, do say, oh, okay, just kidding. Prevention we will pay for, but everything that's not prevention, we won't. Now the issue here, not a bad concept, but we've got to let 10 years go by with these high deductible plans to see if people's health suffers or not. The concept's great. People are saving money hand over fist because they're spending less. The real problem is, are they spending less? And in fact, are their outcomes, are they having more heart attacks, more diabetes, more cancer from less screening?
Yeah, you could spend less in the short term, but you might end up spending more in the long term if you get sick and you're not taking care of yourself.
There you go.
Tim Garson, provost at the University of Virginia. Let's go back to the phones. Jonathan on line three. Jonathan, you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go right ahead.
All right, thanks. Nice to talk to you, doctor. I'm a veteran. I was in the U.S. Navy for 6 years, and the consensus amongst all the active duty military that I dealt with was that the healthcare system in the active duty military was very similar to what they're proposing now, socialized medicine, where as an active duty member of the armed services, you went to the doctor and the government paid for it. And the care had a really bad reputation. Do you foresee that happening here?
Again, if you've got about 6 or 7 hours, we can delve into this. Let me be quick. The care, first of all, I don't have any way of knowing outcomes-wise whether the care is or isn't any worse in the armed forces for that same population of people. So I just don't know the data. So the first thing is I don't know in terms of what the outcome is. What I can tell you is that no one is that what you're talking about in the Navy in the active duty armed services is essentially a single payer, that the doctors are paid by the government, the hospitals are paid by the government, and it is a complete, you don't get to go out of the system, it's Canada. Now, no one is proposing that in the United States of America. So when you say socialized health care, no, sir, that's not, no one is proposing that.
And that's an important point to make. That is not part of President Obama's plan at all, that we adopt a Canadian model or a French model or anything
like that. Yeah, I mean, the interesting difference, and I think it's important, even though it may not sound important, is that in Canada you have no choice. In Canada you've got one healthcare system, just like the Navy, and you can't go anywhere else unless you pay 100% of it. So if you want other kinds of care than Canada, you go to Detroit. In all other systems, England, France, Germany, you have the ability to go buy private insurance. It's the Canadian one that is the most, you know, one payer, have a nice day, nothing else.
The most, quote-unquote, socialized.
That's right, and no one is proposing that.
We're talking with Dr. Tim Garson of the University of Virginia. Let's go to Dave on line one. Dave, you're on with Dr. Garson. Go right ahead.
Hi, Dr. Garson. I was curious. Nobody is talking about healthcare itself, the healthcare industry, the actual patient services, the inefficiencies, the legal challenges that they face from lawsuits and the cost that that incurs. No, and in this whole discussion, it seems to all be about the insurance of covering the healthcare. And no one that I've heard in not just this show, but anywhere is talking about, you know, fixing the chronic and somewhat ingrained problems with our healthcare system.
Oh, I think a lot of people are. They may not be yelling loud enough, but let me give you a couple of examples. In the president's stimulus package, there's a huge amount of money that is now being given for healthcare information technology. And what that will do eventually is improve care. It's not just about, gee, let's make it easier for a patient to make an appointment, which is good. But ultimately decision support, helping doctors to decide very quickly, instantly. You hit F4 and it says, you know, no, that antibiotic isn't any good. This one is. And, oh, by the way, it's better and it's cheaper. So that change in how to practice medicine, not cookbooks, the right stuff, because the thing that happens with F4 was created by doctors.
Right, right.
That is coming, and is coming hopefully a lot sooner than some people thought, because the stimulus legislation in fact said there is going to be a penalty 5 years from now for doctors that don't use electronic medical records. And you better believe docs are going to pay attention to that.
Clarify something, because I think when some people hear, and Dave, thank you for the call. When some people hear electronic medical records, they think, oh, I'm going to go into some big system and my whole life history and everything is going to be in a computer somewhere and every doctor will be able to look at it. Explain exactly what it means to people.
Great. So what it means very simply is you have a chart, and you have a chart now in your doctor's office. And that chart is in some people, remember, 60% of people over 65 have at least one chronic disease. So you walk into the doctor's office and you have a chart that's 6 to 12 inches thick. And the doctor, every time you come in, has to go looking through that chart and saying, oh, gee, I don't remember what this is or that is. What the electronic medical record is taking that chart and putting it in a computer. The only person who has access to that is your doctor. And you have to give permission for who can see that. That's the way this is going to work. So very, very careful privacy. And what the doctor gets to do is instantly look up and see what's wrong with you and not take 20 minutes to look through a foot thick of paperwork, all right? Then you've got a specialist that you see somewhere. You've got a primary care doc you've seen somewhere else. And then you get sick on vacation in North Carolina. Well, all of those with the patient's permission are available instantly because they're all integrated. Now, that's not next week, but 5 to 10 years from now, that's what an electronic medical record.
And you have said before that is one of the critical elements that healthcare in America absolutely needs moving forward.
Absolutely, absolutely, not any doubt. And I mean, it's one of the very few things. Sometimes better quality care actually costs money. But this is one of the very few things that's going to save money, and like billions. Some of the things, almost enough to pay for the uninsured, the estimates are that we will ultimately save with electronic records, but not this week, somewhere in the 5 to 10 year time frame.
And the privacy is a real thing. It's not like phone company privacy where we can share your records with friends of our company that want to offer you deals.
The privacy must be a real thing, and there are people who are spending their lives making it right.
We're talking with Tim Garson of the University of Virginia. Let's go back to the phones. Margo, are you with us?
Yes, hi. How are you doing?
Very good. Go right ahead.
The question I had was, doctors' attitudes at keeping patients alive at all costs, does the lawsuits have an effect on how they practice medicine?
Yes. And it is really difficult to tell exactly how much, but I'll give you an example. When a patient gets very sick and has an arrest in a nursing home, and does not have an advance directive that says don't resuscitate me, they must resuscitate the patient. And if they don't, it is certainly possible, and we see it, for a family who's never seen Uncle Joe to come flying in and say, well, what do you mean you didn't resuscitate him? You didn't, he's 99 and a half years old, and what do you mean you didn't resuscitate him? I'm suing you. So that's a pretty obvious one, but that happens. So, yes, that's, again, why Senator Warner is right on here, is we've got to get better people discussing, at least, what they want done.
Yeah. I mean, a living will is a must. Seems in this country today. I mean, you just have to have one. And is that a kind of thing that a law school student could do pro bono? I mean, is this...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It doesn't even take that much.
I mean, I know I have one, and I'll tell you, it didn't really cost that much, and it was pretty quick.
That's right.
Dr. Tim Garson is an internationally recognized pediatric cardiologist, the co-author of Healthcare Half-Truths, and he's provost at the University of Virginia. Thank you for being here. I've really enjoyed it.
Always a pleasure, Coy. Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.